Hello everyone. If you remember, a couple of weeks ago, I made this video called Why Merchants Prefer Liberal Democracy, where I used the traditional caste system, using the priests, the merchants, the warriors, and the peasants to break down basically where things are. And if you remember, I said that currently we have a situation where we have the merchants supported by a priest class. So currently this is the situation we have here. Now, a lot of people were quite interested in knowing more about this way of breaking things down. And I was going to make a video about it. But for whatever reason, I wasn't able to make that video. But instead, I made this Twitter thread, and now I thought, well, I've got a little bit of time, and I can at least record what I said on the Twitter thread. So I wanted to basically break down the traditional castes even further, because there are important subdivisions within the priests, the merchants, and the peasants that we need to be aware of. And there are also, how can I say, interesting ramifications from the reactionary point of view. The Marxists have long used a lens like this, and I have borrowed liberally from the Marxists, in particular Vladimir Lenin, who wrote a book in 1899 called The Development of Capitalism in Russia, where he, among other things, broke down the merchant class and the peasants in various different ways. And I'll mention what I've taken from Lenin here and what I've come up with myself. So to start with, there are the priests. The three main categories of priests are thought leaders. That's the people who generate ideas. In today's world, mostly these are professors. Sometimes they work outside of the academy, but most of the time they'll be thought leaders within universities. Then there are mavens, who disseminate and spread ideas. Today, these are, of course, the journalists, the media. They disseminate and spread those ideas. And then there are the gatekeepers, who police discourse and dogmatically enforce the status quo. And today, that is any number of different functions, whether it be HR, whether it be, some parts of the media act as gatekeepers in this way. Middle managers of various kinds. So there we are. So we have the thought leaders, the mavens, and the gatekeepers. And this is important to realize. This category of the maven, incidentally, I took from Malcolm Gladwell. I thought that was a very interesting insight in his book, The Tipping Point, that you always need a maven to spread the ideas, not necessarily come up with them, but this is somebody with social contacts, who has a network, who's able to get the ideas out there. Whereas a thought leader might not necessarily have those skills themselves. This is the difference between an intellectual, I guess, and a marketer. The maven is good at marketing. And a lot of what the media is good at is this sort of thing. And then, of course, you have the gatekeepers. I think it's important for us to be aware of that, because essentially what we need to do is to recreate a kind of priest class ready to form a new elite for when the time comes, as I've talked about. Now, I know some people are like, oh, what? You mean you and your friend? Not necessarily us. What I'm saying is this is what needs to happen. If there's ever going to be any change, there needs to be a rival elite, and it needs to have all three of these categories. There need to be thought leaders, there need to be mavens, there need to be gatekeepers. And they're not always necessarily the same people. And what's been happening at the moment, if I was to give a bit of critique as to, how things have worked on the right, is that often the same person has to act as all three. So I personally at the moment have to act as a thought leader, as a maven, and as a gatekeeper, whereas obviously my skill set is not necessarily in all three of those things. Yes, other people help me and so on, but so one of the purposes of doing this is for people who are on our side, who want to make a change in a positive direction. You have to think about, well, where am I in this? What is my role? Where could I add the greatest value? Maybe you are a maven. Maybe you are a natural born gatekeeper. All of these things will be required in the long run if there is to be any sort of success. So let us carry on. Now there are the merchants. There are two main categories of merchant. There's manufacturing. Often that is called the real economy or Main Street today. And there is finance or Wall Street or the money lenders or the usurers, as they've been known over the ages. And Lenin, in fact, this is one of the divisions that he makes. He says, listen, there is always a divergence between the interests of the producers, the manufacturers, and the interests of finance. There's a natural animosity between these two groups, and they often kind of come into political conflict for various different reasons. However, as Lenin points out, ultimately manufacturers need capital. They often need startup loans. They often need money. But they distrust finance, the manufacturers, because, financial types, they don't make anything. They're not producing value in a way that can be seen. And so therefore, traditional manufacturers have often kind of had a wary relationship with finance as a kind of necessary evil. Also, finance is not trusted by the manufacturer because the financier doesn't care about location. He would be happy to sell out his own country if he can make a buck elsewhere in a heartbeat. There's nothing tying finance down, whereas the manufacturer is rooted in a particular location. Now, that has been less and less the case over time as capital has become more mobile. And as companies have become more multinational, I guess, there's less tying, let's say, a company like Ford's to the United States. They can set up shop in Mexico, they can set up shop in India, whatever. Traditionally, at least, there has been this, tension between the international financier and a manufacturer who is nation-based. So let's carry on. I think it's worth being aware of the divergent interests of finance and manufacturing, because when you start to think about it, they're not always aligned. And in some cases, they are at odds. So I'll say more about this in a second. Next, there are the peasants who represent the vast mass of people. And I would say the peasants are more than 80% of people minimum, if not more, possibly even up to 90% of people. And they represent a vast swathe of the population. They can be categorized as urban and rural at the broadest level. But further subdivisions are necessary beyond this. So there's always been this urban-rural divide. During the Industrial Revolution, of course, many people moved from the countryside into the cities. But still, there are many people who live in the country. The urban peasants can be split into artisanal craftsmen or tradesmen. That's your old-fashioned blacksmiths and carpenters and various trades of different sorts. It would also include things like bakers and weavers and tailors and all of these sorts of old trades. They would have been attached to a guild once upon a time. But in recent years, these would be your white van men, your plumbers, your any trade basically. And they tend to be, small scale producers, small business owners, they are the backbone of many economies as well. So there's this group, the tradesmen. And then over here you have what we call the industrial working class. They didn't exist as such before about 1750. You could push that date forwards or backwards depending on the location and depending on how you want to measure it. I would say realistically about 1750 is where we see the emergence of the industrial working class in Great Britain at the very least. Later in other parts of Europe, and to some extent we might argue, well, how much does this industrial working class still exist in a place like the UK or in America? I would say they're still there. The old blue collar, I mean, America has, I would say, still, I wouldn't say it's thriving, but it exists. There is a blue collar class in America that still exists. And in Britain, we actually do more manufacturing. There are more jobs like this in the economy than you might imagine. I think we're encouraged to think that this class no longer exists at all. That is not true if you really start looking at the numbers. What has changed is the proportion of the population who belong to that class, but it doesn't mean that there's nobody there at all. People think, well, okay, they're working in retail. They're working in Tesco's or they're working in the Amazon warehouse. That is not necessarily the case either. There are actually manufacturing jobs. There are jobs. There are dock jobs still, even. So I would encourage people to have a look to see, what is the true extent of that working class in the West. Then we can look at the rural peasantry, and this is again Lenin's categorization, although you don't need to go to Lenin for this. This has long been the case in a country like Britain. You have the yeoman farmer. These were called kulaks by Lenin. They own their own land. You have the tenant farmer who rents their land, either from an aristocrat or from a kulak. Often the tenant farmer will have their own capital equipment. They'll have their own stock. They'll run the business basically, but they pay rent rather than owning their own land. And there's a huge number of tenant farmers all across the world. That has been, it doesn't matter which country really, there's a good chunk of the population who will be tenant farmers. And then finally, you have the landless peasant. Now, this category of rural peasant, I would say, has been gutted in a country like the UK. Last I saw, something like 1% of the UK population worked in agriculture. So, whereas once it was at, 80% plus. So there's a very, this category of person is virtually non-existent in the UK. But in America, I think this category of, even though there are moves, I guess, to try to eliminate this type of peasant in America in various different ways, whether it's the land, the small farmer who owns their own land, the kulak, the tenant farmer, or the farm laborer, the landless peasant. Even though there have been moves to try to attack and to buy up the land under their feet and to gradually stop that way of life, and we're watching it happen, Bill Gates, etc. They still exist in America as things stand. Okay. People from rural parts of America can correct me if I'm wrong, but as far as I've seen, there's still very much a kind of rural peasantry in America and also on the continent in Europe. It's just really the UK that has a much reduced agricultural sector. I will say, even though it's 1% or even 0.5% of the entire population, that agricultural sector in the UK produces like more than half the food in the country. So it's incredibly productive as a sector. It's just not that many people anymore. Finally, an important class to talk about is the underclass, what the Marxists call the lumpen proletariat. This is an important class to consider as well. Now, who are these people in the modern setting? Well, they're people, they're at all times and places, they're thugs, they're criminals, they're vagrants. Today, a lot of these people would be on welfare. It's your kind of crack fiends, all of these, traditionally undesirable types. Today, of course, this underclass is openly celebrated by the regime. They're in some cases kind of elevated to near sainthood, and I'll talk about that in a moment and its implications. Now, it strikes me that the current system is held in place chiefly through an alliance between finance and the secular priest class, aka the cathedral, who use this lumpen proletariat as a client group. So the alliance is between finance, this half of the merchant class, if you want, which has become dominant, and the priests. Those are the kind of leading coalition, but they are held in place by not the peasant, not the rural peasants, not the working class, but just the lumpen proletariat, the underclass, who, I mean, Marxists always wrote off the lumpen proletariat as being kind of just kind of useful idiots for the power regime. They were like, oh, these guys are never going to be like revolutionaries. Whereas that thinking seems to have turned around now. Whereas now the current regime, if you want, use this underclass as a kind of battering ram, as a kind of hammer to bash the heads of everybody else. I don't need to spell that out for you. It's pretty obvious. It has also been laid out in Spandrel's essay, Bio-Leninism, as well, which talks about this phenomena. Now, Marxists long identified the rural peasantry as reactionary types, whether they are kulak or landless, and the left has somewhat written these off. In the USA, this is your redneck kind of country bumpkin Trump type voter. Now it's kind of interesting reading like Lenin on this. He was like, well, the trouble with the landless peasants is that they're uneducated, basically. They don't know, they wouldn't wake up even if you tried to. And the kulaks, he says, are basically like capitalists, so they're never going to be radicals in the Marxist sense. Whereas the middle peasantry, according to Lenin, are really the ones who are going to go to move to the cities to become this industrial working class over here. So these tenant farmers become industrial working class. They are the ones who move, whereas the landless peasants, they don't have the means to move, and they're also like stupid, basically, so they're not going to. And the kulak, well, it's not in his interest to move because he's making a good buck, you know, running his own farm. So, so that's an important thing to realize. I don't know how many tenant farmers still exist. Maybe none exist in 2021. You would have to have a look at the situation on the ground. I would be not surprised if this class of person no longer exists in the USA. But you would have to tell me. If they don't exist, that these people here ended up as these people over here. Okay, so I'm gonna carry on. Now, there was a hidden war in the American elite between Wall Street and Main Street in the 1910s and the 1920s. By 1945, Wall Street won definitively, and we have seen American manufacturing smashed to smithereens ever since. Now, I'll say a bit more about this here. I have in mind, there was an alliance that people don't really know about. Henry Ford, of course, the car manufacturer, as you all know, he didn't like Wall Street very much. He was distrustful of accountants, and he had this kind of old-fashioned view that the heart of the economy was in productive labor, in work, in manufacturing, as you might imagine, for somebody who ran a car factory. But he had many allies. Carnegie was one of them. Rockefeller was one of them. J.P. Morgan, the famous financier, he was one of them. And they basically, through newspaper campaigns, through financing their own operations, they ran really quite a spirited opposition to finance and to the Wall Street set. I'll just put it that way, to international finance. And there was a tussle back and forth. One of the major things they tussled over was the 1924 Immigration Act. And they actually won that one, the manufacturing coalition. They managed to win that against Wall Street. But in the long run, especially because of World War II, and especially because they didn't like FDR much either. J.P. Morgan didn't like FDR. Henry Ford was friends with Herbert Hoover, so you can actually see that there was this sharp dividing line between the elites at that time. But anyway, in the long run, it was Wall Street that won. And by 1945, after the war, and then, what happened during the war and who the opposition were, and, some of the atrocities done by that opposition, and that, and the fact that this coalition I'm talking about, Ford and Friends, had helped the Germans to some extent, in the run-up to the war. All of these things basically were used to basically put an end to that that side of the American elite. And in the second half of the 20th century, you can basically see the taking over of finance, and of course you see the absolute smashing to smithereens of American manufacturing. All of these guys died, they would, like, by the late 1950s, the 60s, all of those old school industrialists were dead, and their companies and their funds and their foundations were then taken over by, the management class, who are the proxies of finance, who they use their assets to their own interests rather than the interests of manufacturing, if that makes any sense. And it's pretty obvious. I would say if you just look at the facts and what happened. Okay. This means, however, that big manufacturing firms should be against the cathedral when push comes to shove, even if they are in the hands of managers who are proxies of finance. You know, at the end of the day, the current state of things is just devastating American manufacturing. In fact, they backed Donald Trump with money in the election. He repaid them with protectionist policies, and those policies are now being undone by Biden and Wall Street. I mean, this split between Main Street and Wall Street was very, very obvious in the election between Trump and Biden. And unfortunately, yet again, Wall Street have won, whether legitimately or not, you know, you can debate, but that's what's happened. The undoing of the pipeline by Biden. I mean, all of these things are just devastating to, you know, U.S. domestic manufacturing and its industrial sector, basically. You know, the energy self-sufficiency that Trump was trying to go for, all undone. The smashing of manufacturing also means, but importantly for us, that means that manufacturing is a natural ally, you know, against the progressive alliance, if you want to put it that way. I mean, you may have a different view on this. If you don't think the manufacturing is a natural ally, explain why, because I think manufacturing should be, you know, part of any sort of reactionary alliance. The smashing manufacturing also means that the old industrial working class, once fertile recruitment grounds for the left, don't forget, you know, the labor movement came out of the working men, and they were like left wing at one time. But that has become reactionary in so much as they are not for the merchant-led coalition, and in so much as that traditional working class resent the client underclass. Okay, and we can see this, you know, especially in the UK. You think of people from those sorts of backgrounds that who are in our circles, like Morgoth, for example. You know, it's obvious that the working class should be a recruitment ground for reactionaries, and you know, not for the left, who have basically abandoned them for this client underclass. So the old manufacturing working class, once the basis of the proletariat's revolution for the Marxists, they've lost those, basically. So that's a huge, so not only have they lost the rural peasants, but they've basically lost the urban peasantry as well. So let's carry on here. Furthermore, the tradesmen, that other half of the urban peasantry, what we call today the small business owner, the white van man, those guys are naturally antithetical to leftism because they are, you know, typically they're going to be self-starters. They're going to be people who are used to running their own affairs. You know, I mean, I happen to know, like, when you're running your own business, paying tax is not like when it just goes out automatically. You actually have to sit down and do them, and it hurts to give those taxes away. So, I would say that you know, the small business owner, you know, this category, the tradesman, they're going to be natural allies in any reactionary coalition as well. So, I hope you're kind of taking notes here as to who the various people, you know, are that are going to be making up this potential coalition I'm talking about. New industries, for example, the tech giants, you might think of like any of the Silicon Valley firms. It's important to recognize that the tech giants are not some new thing or some entity on their own. They are not just proxies of Wall Street. They are the creation of Wall Street. Most of those tech firms have vastly inflated share prices, divorced from the real economy, and everyone knows this. And you actually see Wall Street creating these kind of bubble, like this fake San Francisco economy, where, you know, these firms become IPOs, and, you know, they pump up the share price. Many of them never turned a profit, you know, 10, 15 years, no profits. And yet their share prices, you know, only go one way. So there's a kind of, you know, there's a tech bubble there. I don't know if it'll ever burst, but I'm just saying that, you know, big tech is held in place by Wall Street and Wall Street alone. It's not held in place by the real economy at all. It's just divorced from the real economy, if anything. So that's something else to bear in mind, that you have to see, you know, your Facebooks, and you have to see all of those things as being downstream of Wall Street and as just being an arm of Wall Street. And once you understand that, I think a lot of their actions make a lot more sense. Thus, if we look at society at large, pretty much the entire peasantry, that's the urban peasantry and the rural peasantry, and all its subdivisions, minus that underclass that I mentioned, plus manufacturing-style merchants as well, have natural incentives to be against the current regime of finance plus priests. So I'm envisaging a coalition of basically the entire peasantry plus, you know, manufacturing as the kind of, you know, potential money, basically, to, you know, because you need funds. And I think the manufacturing could be a good funding base. You know, also the tradesmen as well. All of those people, plus, obviously, we would need our own priest class as well to generate the ideas, to spread the ideas, to gatekeep the ideas. And I think all of those people together could then take on the regime of the finance and the priests. And I think one of the things that I think focusing on the finance, on the Wall Street side of things, and exposing that will be something that their priests won't like very much. And at this point, it's obvious. So, you know, there are some pretty good attack vectors there, too. The reactionary coalition could be very big. And if it forms warriors, who I haven't mentioned, I didn't subdivide the warriors because that requires technical expertise, which I lack, sadly. If it comes down to this big reactionary coalition against the finance and the priests, the warriors then ultimately have to decide who they want to back. You know, are they going to back these disloyal, you know, loyal to no one group of anywhere international financiers and their mouthpieces, or are they going to back the people who have a vested interest in the places where they live and who are ultimately going to be everybody that the soldiers know? That's my question. But it may take a very long time to get there. At the moment, I am, of course, putting my efforts into even, like, you know, helping to create, you know, the starts of a proper priest class. But that is my breakdown. Tell me what you think. And I will be back later on for unpopular opinions. You can buy a course at the academic agency. You can check out my back catalogue by getting a channel membership, or you can buy a mug. There's a somebody recently funded a scholarship for the Trivium, but I don't have details yet of how that competition is going to go. There will be a Trivium place to give away soon. And most importantly, give me your thoughts in the show notes for what you made of my ideas here. And I'll see you later.